This is Mark Dankos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is going to be Harry McLean, who is the author of the bestseller In Broad Daylight. This book was the New York Times bestseller for 12 weeks, selling more than 2 million copies 25 years ago. It was made into an NBC Movie of the Week in 1992 with Brian Dennehy playing the lead role. And 25 years after the original publication of In Broad Daylight, the book has now been reissued by St. Martin's Press in a revised and updated edition, and we will be discussing with Harry McLean some of the particulars of that book and why it has been reissued and what the updates are in a case that involves the murder of a town terror in Skidmore, Missouri, by the name of Kenneth McElroy in the summer of 1981. That killing remains unsolved in spite of three grand jury investigations and a nine-month investigation by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. As far as the news summary today is concerned, before we bring Harry on, all kinds of interesting things to report. The NewsObserver.com is telling us that the head of the DNA lab says that he and Nifong agreed not to report the results. The head of this private DNA laboratory said under oath today in reference to the Duke lacrosse controversy that he and District Attorney Mike Nifong agreed not to report DNA results favorable to Duke lacrosse players charged with rape. Brian Mahan, the director of DNA security of Burlington, said his lab found DNA from unidentified men in the underwear, pubic hair, and rectum of the woman who said she was gang raped at a lacrosse party in March. Nurses at Duke Hospital collected the samples a few hours later after the alleged assault. Mahan said the DNA did not come from Reed Seligman, David Evans, or Colin Finnerty, who have been charged with rape and sexual assault in the case. Been previous allegations, of course, that the district attorney, Mike Nifong, has had it in for these Duke lacrosse players. Don't know if that's true or not, but this latest statement by the head of the DNA lab is most interesting. WorldNet Daily reported yesterday that Robert Pastor has indicated that the North American Union is just a merger crisis away. He is a leading intellectual force in the move to create a European Union-style North American community and has told WorldNet Daily, according to Jerome Corsi, that a new 9/11 crisis could be the catalyst to merge the United States, Mexico, and Canada. Pastor is a professor at American University and, of course, is very conversant with folks like those at the Council on Foreign Relations, where Pastor was the co-chairman in May of 2005 for a task force that produced a report entitled Toward a North American Community, which he claims is the blueprint behind the Security and Prosperity Partnership arrangement declared by President Bush, Mexico's then-President Vicente Fox, and Canada's then-Prime Minister Paul Martin. Keep an eye on that story. Robert Pastor reappearing again, pushing the North American community, merging the United States, Mexico, and Canada, says that it would just take a new 9/11 crisis to be the catalyst to achieve that. Some other interesting stories today. Al Jazeera.info is talking about Hillary Clinton hiring a, get ready folks, hiring a faith consultant. Al Jazeera.info reprints a story by Robert Maris, basically saying that following a trend of Democrats becoming more faith-friendly, Hillary Clinton has hired a Baptist faith guru for her expected 2008 presidential campaign. Bernd Strider, who has been the head of religious outreach for the House Democratic Caucus since 2005, will join Clinton's campaign staff, according to the hotline. The online daily is the politics arm of the National Journal, one of Washington's oldest political publications. Bernd Strider is a native of Mississippi, raised Southern Baptist. He and his family now attend Metropolitan United Methodist Church in Washington. And whether it's Hillary Clinton or it's George Bush, my reaction to that is, give us a break, folks. We will be back with Harry McLean in Broad Daylight when Mark Dankos America returns live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned.
The Idaho Observer is one of the last independent American presses and isn't afraid to print the truth. The Idaho Observer is a monthly 24-page hard copy newspaper in its fifth year of addressing important issues affecting all freedom-loving Americans. If you are concerned about the burgeoning national debt and the Orwellian police state growing up around you, then subscribe to the Idaho Observer. Only $25 for 12 monthly issues. Idaho Observer readers receive vital insight into events as they unfold. Our articles editorially emphasize activism and serve as a networking tool for like-minded individuals determined to make a difference. The Idaho Observer, printing what you need to be fully informed on issues that matter to real Americans. Go to idaho-observer.com or call 208-255-2307. That's 208-255-2307.
Attention, friends of freedom and liberty. Our constitutional republic is under a vicious attack by the sinister forces of world globalization. The hour is late, and we must all actively engage our families, friends, and neighbors before it's too late. Now you can exercise your constitutional right of free speech with a statement t-shirt from the Republic Broadcasting Network and NoTyranny.com. Wearing a statement t-shirt causes people to think, challenge, and debate what they've been spoon-fed by the controlled corporate media. There's no time to sit around in fear asking yourself, what can I do? Now is the time to make a strong public statement with one of the many t-shirts from Republic Broadcasting Network and NoTyranny.com. Go to RBNLive.com's Freedom Store, NoTyranny.com, or call 800-724-2719. It's true. Gold and silver have been a source of true wealth for years. In fact, people around the world have used these metals to buy and sell goods for over 5,000 years. And gold and silver will continue to be a source of true wealth for the foreseeable future. If you look back in history, you'll see that all fiat currencies have failed to maintain wealth or failed altogether. But gold has always protected its holder, a true asset, usable to anyone around the globe. As the value of your Federal Reserve note continues to depreciate, gold will be your only insurance. As an example, in 1975, you could buy a $40,000 home with 1,000 gold coins. Today, that same house is $400,000, yet you can still buy it with 1,000 gold coins. To find out more information on how to protect your wealth, call Republic Trading at 1-800-691-7898. That's 1-800-691-7898.
America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Harry McLean, the author of In Broad Daylight. And before I introduce him, just wanted to mention a couple of other news articles that I will be trying to post at Breaking All the Rules News later, the nation's leading paleo-conservative news service. Mathaba.net has some eyewitness accounts from people who were at the so-called Tehran Holocaust Conference. Be interesting to read the original texts of some of those speeches. A lot of trouble between Hamas and Fatah in terms of Gaza, and as far as charge and countercharge related to the legitimacy of governments and the possible movement in Gaza towards civil war. The British Independent is talking about that today. And then something that we've been talking about previously on this show, keep an eye for the results of the Assembly of Experts elections in Tehran, and as well as the Tehran City Council elections. Preliminary reports that maybe Ahmadinejad has suffered something of a vote setback in those elections, and that our old friend Rafsanjani may be on the ascendancy again in terms of the outcome of the vote totals, but it's too early to tell. We may not have a more definitive report from Tehran for the next 24 hours or so, but keep an eye on those stories. The Financial Times is talking about it. Yahoo's talking about it. The BBC has an article on it today, and we will simply keep an eye on that for you in the days that are ahead. Switching gears now to Harry McLean's bestseller In Broad Daylight. This book won an Edgar for Best True Crime Award and was a New York Times bestseller for 12 weeks, selling more than 2 million copies. It was made into an NBC Movie of the Week in 1992 with Brian Dennehy playing the lead role. 25 years after the original publication of In Broad Daylight, the book has been issued by St. Martin's Press in a revised and updated edition this December 4th, 68 pages longer than the original work. This book deals with the murder of a town terror by the name of Kenneth McElroy in Skidmore, Missouri, in the summer of 1981. He was killed in an act of fear and retribution by local townspeople in front of multiple eyewitnesses. The killing remains unsolved in spite of 3 grand jury investigations and a 9-month investigation by the FBI. Harry McLean's new edition of In Broad Daylight contains previously undisclosed information about the killing and provides detailed information about the witnesses and the killers. And this weekend, I was also taking a look at an article in the Rocky Mountain News in Colorado regarding this book and regarding the work of Harry McLean. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, Mark. How are you?
Good. In terms of beginning this conversation, tell us a little bit about Kenneth McElroy and what he was doing in Skidmore, Missouri, in the events leading up to July 10th, 1981. What happened in terms of his killing, as near as we can tell, and what has been going on with this case in the last 25 years?
Well, you gave an excellent summary of the facts, I must say. Ken McElroy was a barely literate hog farmer living on the outside of Skidmore, Missouri, which is a little town of 425 people. And he had an uncanny, he was a bully. But he was more than a bully. He had a sense of people's weaknesses. He had a sense of how to exploit their fear. And he ran wild over all of northwest Missouri and actually into southern Iowa and Kansas for about 25 years before he was gunned down on the main streets of Skidmore.
Yeah, the incredible thing to me as I was reading the book is getting into this, this whole question of this guy. He certainly had a real long run before all that came to a sudden end. I mean, quite clearly, he, both in Skidmore, Missouri, and elsewhere in northwestern Missouri and in southern Iowa and I guess in Kansas, had quite a long period of time where his own career in crime pretty much went unchecked. I mean, I found myself being amazed that with some of the things that are cataloged in your book, that this whole thing went on for as long as it did. What's your take on that?
There were really 2 reasons why he was very intimidating. He had everybody scared. He had the judges scared. He had the cops scared. He had the sheriff scared. He had the jurors scared. Most prosecutors were scared to charge him. If they did charge him, the judge very often dismissed the case. If it went to trial, he intimidated the jurors. He put snakes in their mailboxes, or he had his friends follow their children's school bus to school. And he also was very cunning in the way he committed his crimes. He did them at night. He hired a very high-priced Kansas City mob lawyer who was able to find all the loopholes. But his basic characteristic was he just had everybody so scared of him that they wouldn't stand up to him.
Yeah, you know, this some of the elements of that remind me of a case here in San Antonio, Texas, highly publicized case at the time involving the assassination of a federal judge on Broadway Street here in San Antonio as he was coming out of the Chateau de Hone apartment complex where he lived. This federal judge, John J. Wood, is the individual for whom the federal court building is now named in downtown San Antonio. But this whole thing had heavy-duty criminal connections behind it, mm-hmm. and there were specific names that came up in regard to that case, and international drug cartels were rumored to be involved. And I don't know to this date, because I haven't studied up on this in recent years, to determine if there's been any additional information that's come forth, but quite clearly the whole thing involved elements that seemed to be running free for a very long period of time, because they had a lot of people terrorized, not simply in the local communities where they operated, but as is the case in the Kenneth McElroy situation that you chronicle, they had a lot of people intimidated in the legal community and in the law enforcement community.
There was a situation where I actually tracked a call that the sheriff department had to come in to Skidmore to deal with another trespassing problem. The sheriff was radioed that he received a radio call that Ken McElroy was in town at the tavern, and he turned around and drove out of town. That's how scared they were of him. Now, they told each other, all the state patrol and the sheriffs and the local cops said, if you catch him alone on the back roads at night, on the back roads at night, and he is carrying a gun, shoot him. That was an articulated agreement amongst law enforcement. That's the only way they thought they could deal with it.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me as I read a little bit about Skidmore. Chapter 2 of your book talks about it. It's a small town in the heart of northwest Missouri farm country. I was interested looking at the geographic details of this place via a map that you have printed in the front of the book. But it's right in that corridor, that railroad corridor between Kansas City and Omaha, where my parents' hometown, Hamburg, Iowa, resides, mm-hmm. which is right on the border. It's in Fremont County, Iowa. It's on the I-29 corridor as well between Kansas City and Missouri. And Hamburg, Iowa, is right on that border between, it's in Iowa, and it's bordered by Missouri and Nebraska, where if you drive 5 minutes either to the west or the south, you're in one of the other states. And to me, what is interesting is that, you know, people have their idyllic ideas, I suppose, as to what these small towns are like. And they're a throwback, many people believe, to a previous era in American history when we were far more of an agrarian society than we are today. There tends to be a perception that there's a strong religious ethos of a bygone era going back to the middle America, the Depression that resonates in these towns. And yet, by the same token, when we talk about a case like this one involving Skidmore, Missouri, and Kenneth McElroy, there's a completely different picture, it seems to me, that emerges in regard to the downside of a small town life in America. Comment on that a little bit for us.
Well, the towns in northwest Missouri and in a lot of the Midwest have been on an economic decline for really since the Depression. They never really recovered. So now the farmland is rich. It's not like the farmers are starving, but the little towns themselves are dying off. And in addition to that, these towns in northwest Missouri, and I think throughout all of Missouri, the people there are very independent-minded. They are, to use a common phrase, they believe strongly in limited government, which means, and that's fine, and that's certainly a worthwhile value, but what it means in some situations is they don't have a cohesive community. They don't have a strong sense of community. They don't have strong leaders. They don't want it that way. They want to kind of do their farming and have their kids and pass their land on to the next generation. One of the results of that lifestyle is that somebody like Ken McElroy, it's fertile ground for him because he can roam and he can do stuff and people will just kind of let it go, hoping that he will, you know, satisfy himself or go away. But they didn't have a strong community response to him because the town really wasn't a strong town.
Yes, and you also make the point on page 18 in your book, in chapter 2, that a lot of the roots of Skidmore, Missouri, and of the state of Missouri generally, have a strong southern history and sociology to them that, in your view, may play a role in the larger context of this as well.
Yeah, I mean, Missouri was a slaveholding state. It had a strong, you know, the whole... A lot of the Civil War veterans from the South came back to Missouri after the Civil War. The whole Jesse and Frank James story, all of those guys were former. If they weren't members of the Confederate Army, they were members of the kind of free-floating militia. And in Skidmore, they had a history. In 1928, they took a black guy who was accused of rape and strung him over a schoolhouse building and set him on fire. And all that means today is that they really don't like a strong law enforcement presence. Skidmore didn't have a marshal. The sheriff came through twice a day. And
we will be back with Harry McLean of In Broad Daylight when Mark Dankos America returns, broadcasting live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned.
Since 1988, Herbal Healer Academy has been the global supplier of the finest natural medicines. We specialize in keeping you alive and healthy. We provide outstanding products like ECX, colloidal silver, olive leaf extract, oregano oil, and hundreds of herbals, oils, books, and educational materials. We have homeopathic detox solutions for chemtrails, radiation, MSG, and aspartame poisoning. We also train naturopathic healers via correspondence education. Why wait any longer? Go ahead and do it today. Sign up on the web and receive our new 120-page catalog and a current Herbal Healer newsletter free. Simply log on to herbalhealer.com and check out the online member testimonials and our hundreds of exceptional products. That's herbalhealer.com, your website for safe, effective, natural alternatives and education. That's herbalhealer.com.
In the United States, it is now estimated that over 90% of family income is now being used to pay back consumer debt. Because of financial problems, mostly from credit card debt, approximately 1 in 4 families struggle to pay bills on even basic necessities such as mortgage, food, and utilities. And with millions of people desperately searching for a fresh start, North American Educational Services is here to help you regain your financial independence. We are very proud that the Debt Relief Educational Services Program has helped over 8,100 families nationwide since 1998, eliminating over $215 million of credit card debt, and still counting, and enabled clients to stop monthly payments immediately. The NAES program is unique, designed to help you, the consumer, not your creditors. To take back your financial freedom, call 1-888-245-7097. That's 1-888-245-7097. Or visit www.integritydebtoptions.com.
We've all considered solar power at one time or another, and self-sufficiency will be your key to a better future. Ken Solar can help you get off the grid and become self-sufficient with solar power, and for a lot less than you would think. One of Ken's most popular items right now is the new solar power generator, for a lot less than you'd expect. This portable system can chop off nearly a third of your electric bill, a good start for any families out there wanting to get solar power for your home. Visit Ken's website at kensolar.com for free downloads, free videos, and how-tos, and of course, the new solar power generator. Use the coupon code RBN with your purchase and save an additional 10% off your order. Get a solar power generator now from kensolar.com at 239-677-3073. Again, that's 239-677-3073 or on the web at kensolar.com. Ken Solar, the home of all your solar needs.
America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Harry McLean, the author of In Broad Daylight, originally a New York Times bestseller for 12 weeks, now reissued 25 years later in an updated, revised edition by St. Martin's Press. Harry, if you can remember where we were when we were interrupted by the commercial break, go on ahead.
Well, I think we were talking about the role that the geography, that the fact that Missouri had been a slave. Well, I grew up in Nebraska. You grew up in Iowa. That's the Midwest. And when I went to Missouri, I thought it was the Midwest too. The town I grew up in was 800 people. It had a very different feel to it. All of Missouri, particularly that northwest area and the southern part of it that's just north of Arkansas, it felt more like Arkansas than it did Kansas. Let's put it that way.
Yes. And in reading the book, does this sociology play a role in what seems to be pretty much a unified town response, not only to McElroy in terms of the fact that there was eventually a murder plot hatched against him, ostensibly to protect the townspeople where they felt that law enforcement and or the legal system had failed them. But, you know, it was striking to me that we're talking about a killing that, as the very title of your book tells us, was committed in broad daylight in the main part of town there in Skidmore. There were either two or three shooters involved, depending on whose version of events is believed. It's generally believed, as I understand it, that there was somebody with a high-powered rifle, somebody shooting with a .22, somebody, a third person may have been involved with a shotgun. But the long and the short of it is that there was a town meeting on July 10th, 1981. 45 of the town's men decided to take action. There was subsequently a situation where, you know, again, at least two men were involved in actually shooting him. At least three or four shots were fired. And despite the fact that this occurred in front of a plethora of eyewitnesses, you end up with three grand jury investigations and a nine-month investigation by the FBI, which never ultimately got to the bottom of who the trigger men were. Is that a part of the ethos of a small town here that had banded together and had said, hey, we're not only going to get rid of this guy, we're going to have, you know, some sort of a virtual blood oath pact that it doesn't matter who comes to talk to us from the outside, even if it's the FBI or even if it's Harry McLean, we ain't talking.
Well, that is actually one of the more interesting parts of the story. I found three parts are interesting. How did McElroy get away with his reign of terror so long? How was he killed? What brought the killing about? And the silence afterwards, because we had 45 farmers, most of whom had at most a high school education, most of whom never had contact with federal law enforcement. Let's say were fairly unsophisticated in dealing with the criminal justice system. They were hauled in front of a federal grand jury in Kansas City after the FBI had interrogated them for weeks. They stood there, they raised their right hand, and they did not tell the truth. Because I know what one of the interesting things in the epilogue, when I got into the investigative files, I found out who was standing where. And I could place him on the street. I could draw a large diagram and put McElroy in his truck across the street with the high-powered shooter. And in between the two of them, up a little bit north up the street, was where the men were standing. And they initially said, well, we heard the shooting and we jumped down between the trucks, or I hit the ground, or you know, I just ran between the buildings. But the fact is, when you actually look at where they were, they either were looking at the killers when it started, or when the shots were fired, they certainly looked about 10 degrees to their left to see where they were coming from. So the fact that they were witnesses to it and that they didn't talk afterwards, the reason they didn't talk, and what I found out in this last couple of years was the nature, it was called a conspiracy of silence, which kind of implies that there was an agreement not to talk about what they had seen. And this is what comes back to the nature of these men. They were all men that were witnesses. They had grown up together. Their parents had grown up together. They breathed the same air. They thought alike. They talked about seed prices every morning at 7:30 in the cafe. Their reaction to having been witnesses was instinctively to shut up. I don't think they ever talked about it amongst themselves. I think those farmers went home, they got on their tractors, they fed their hogs, they went to Maryville and shopped. They went about their life, they buried it. I don't think they told their wives. I don't think they told their kids. Other than the killers and their friends, I don't think they talked about it. They understood instinctively that they were going to keep their mouth shut, and they have.
You know, that's really interesting. I just wanted to correct one thing that you said, Harry, and that is that my parents were from Iowa, but I wasn't raised there. I was a military kid. My dad was an Air Force colonel, and just to summarize this for the listeners, to put it into context, because I think it's an important point getting at some of the really incredible information that you're giving us today. When we come back from the next break, I want to talk about this a little bit and then come back to this whole business of the code of silence of the Middle Western farmer. We will be back with Harry McLean, the very fine author of In Broad Daylight, St. Martin's Press, when Mark Dankoff's America returns on the Republic Broadcasting Network live from San Antonio. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Americans who already realize our nation is in deep trouble need special edition hard copy literature to awaken the widest possible spectrum of people to the imminence of our nation's peril. The Artificially Sweetened Times informs people that the artificial sweetener aspartame is a hidden addiction killing people worldwide with a cluster of symptoms we now call Rumsfeld's disease. Find out who's responsible for unleashing this weapon of mass misery on the world and become part of the global movement to eliminate this neurotoxic drug from our food supply. The People's Income Tax Guide cites congressional records, Supreme Court decisions, and newspaper articles at the time to prove conclusively that wages were never intended to be taxed as income. A lot has happened in the world since 9/11. The report of the Citizens Commission on 9/11 disproves the government's explanation of September 11 through a careful analysis of the evidence. The Artificially Sweetened Times, the People's Income Tax Report, and the report of the Citizens Commission on 9/11 are priced for mass distribution. Sample copies are just $3. Call 208-255-2307 or go to idaho-observer.com.
The Republic Broadcasting Network is very proud to present a new educational tool that will inform and update our listeners to the most critically important topics and issues of the day. This new 50 CD collection contains invaluable information, carefully selected from the very best shows in the RBN archives. These standard format CDs have been painstakingly edited to remove all commercials and unrelated topic content. Each CD has been divided into multiple tracks for ease of use and review in any standard CD player. Each CD targets a specific subject matter. For example, Agenda 21, vaccinations, 9/11, depleted uranium, the war in Iraq, fluoride, deception in the churches, genetically modified foods, animal RFID tags, and many more topics. We encourage you to make copies and get them out to as many people as you can. Call and order your library CDs for the price of $150, 800-724-2719, or go to the website rbnlive.com.
Gold, ever climbing, as the dollar continues to spiral into a free fall. How long before it hits rock bottom? Between 1800 and 1913, the value of the dollar was more or less constant. Since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, the value of the dollar has depreciated 97%. Due to global inflationary policies and the continued erosion of the U.S. dollar, gold and silver are still in the early stages of the greatest bull market the world has ever seen. Whether you purchase precious metals to stabilize your portfolio or you're looking for strong growth, gold and silver will provide you with both. Don't you owe it to yourself to do business with Republic Trading Group? Call us today and become a part of the raging bull in gold and silver. 1-800-691-7898. That's 1-800-691-7898. Call now. 1-800-691-7898.
America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Harry McLean, the author of In Broad Daylight, originally published as a bestseller by the New York Times. Or I'm sorry, it was, yeah, that's right. Correct, Harry?
Correct.
And then subsequently published in the last month, republished by St. Martin's Press. Harry, before the break, I was starting to get at something that I've always found fascinating in terms of the sociology of all of this and the codes and the creeds that people in these types of societies live by. I was getting ready to say that, you know, being raised in the military, my parents left this small town in Iowa during the Depression when they graduated from high school in 1938. My dad was the only one of six boys that managed to graduate from high school because of the times. He ended up, he came from a poor farming family. He ended up at the University of Omaha, Nebraska on a football scholarship. Was there when World War II broke out, and the day after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. My dad was a year short of college graduation, but signed up for the Army Air Corps. 32 years later, he was retiring from the Air Force, and 12 years after that, he retired from a career in aerospace, where he was involved in a couple of different Middle Eastern countries, Iran and Saudi Arabia. The long and the short of it is that his kids, meaning my older brother, who's a lawyer in Dayton, Ohio, and I, who do this for Republic Broadcasting Network, and then I'm a Lutheran pastor here in San Antonio, we weren't raised in this small town, but we would go back there, say, every 2 to 3 years to visit relatives and so forth. And I was struck by the fact that being raised in on military reservations around the country, and my brother and I moving around both within the United States and abroad, that we would always go back to this town, finding it, on the one hand, a hospitable place. We liked the farming community. We liked riding horses when we got to go back there. It was kind of neat thinking about being in a small town of, 2,500 people, which is, I guess, down to 1,800 now. And it seemed that they didn't have all of the troubles and dynamics of the very large communities that my brother and I lived in growing up in the Air Force. And yet we always felt that there was, in some sense, a culture and a sociology there that we were not penetrating. We were outsiders. My parents weren't necessarily outsiders, but we were, growing up again in the Air Force and just coming back to this community every so often. And it seems to me that in the dynamics of this, and perhaps this is very much involved at getting to the bottom of what happened in Skidmore, Missouri as well, that isn't there an unspoken insider-outsider mentality in these communities that sometimes works for very unfortunate ends and sometimes for positive ends, but it's very much there, and that even the FBI and the grand jury in Kansas City couldn't penetrate it.
Well, that's absolutely true, and it was certainly there beforehand. I mean, it just kind of by the nature of the community, you either grew up there or you didn't. And I spent over 4 years. I ended up living in that small town, and I got quite attached to the people there and quite attached to the town, and a great deal of empathy for what they had suffered at the hands of Ken McElroy and a very disastrous criminal justice system. So they're very insular. They've known each other all their life. I can remember somebody telling me they had lived there for 15 years and they were still considered an outsider. On the other hand, the people in the small town are still good people. They're warm-hearted, basically good people. And if you take the time to listen to them, if you take the time to understand their situation, I'll always be an outsider. But by the time I left, they had started to open up and relax and tell me their story about what had happened. They are basically God-fearing people. They were put in an impossible position by the three killers. They would not have, the town would not have approved of this act beforehand. But once it happened, they could not turn the killers over to a criminal justice system that has failed them. My sympathy for the town might sound overblown, but they're in a corner, and they're in a corner forever. That town is always going to be known as the town that killed the Ken McElroy, the bully. And yet, there was not a decision by the town to do it beforehand. On the other hand, they had to protect the killers afterwards. One of the ways they said it to me was the killers deserve a medal for what they did, and they deserve to be strung up for the way they did it. In other words, in broad daylight.
Yes, and you know, I was struck as I was reading the book, I was struck by your own, and you talk about it in the book at various points, your own internal conflict on this, because you made it very clear in the book that your sympathy had always lain, quoting you here, had always lain with the townspeople, and yet also as an attorney, you have an unbridled commitment to due process of law, and to doing things in a fashion that are consistent with the best elements of American jurisprudence. And I suspect that throughout your research for this book, you found yourself torn in two completely different directions in regard to your own take on this.
Absolutely. I can remember when I was on the Larry King show, and he, at the end of the show, he said, you know, I just don't think it's ever right to take somebody's life outside the law. And I've heard that sentiment a lot, and quite frankly, I tend to agree with it, but I turned to him and said, what if it was your daughter that was being raped What if it was your house that was burning down? What if it was your wife that was being shot in the neck with a shotgun and not being prosecuted, walking free crime after crime? At some point, don't you think you have the right to protect yourself? And that's, you can make a very strong case that this is one of those situations. And on the other hand, the killers acted as judge, jury, and executioner, which goes against the very bedrock notion of this country.
Yeah, and that was the thing that struck me, the moral complexity, the ethical complexity of this as I was reading through this 400-plus page narrative. I've often confronted this as a Lutheran clergyman when someone in complete confidence, and again, you have just done an admirable job to me in developing the level of trust with the people in this town that you ended up coming closer to the truth on this than anyone has come before, even though the absolute truth has not been revealed and may never be revealed. But the point is that when you develop rapport with people, whether you're an attorney and an investigative journalist like you are, or a Lutheran pastor like I am, who, interestingly enough, has also been involved in investigative journalism from time to time, you get into something like this, and you begin to see that on the one hand, if somebody shares something with you in confidence that pertains to a dreadful situation, something that transpires that none of us who are committed to the principle of the rule of law could possibly say, yeah, that's a good thing that you did this or that he or she did that. And yet by the same token, when you talk the thing through and they begin to share all of the dynamics with you in regard to what went into the decision, assuming that they're truthful, for sake of argument, at the same time you come away from it thinking, boy, I could really see the moral and ethical complexity of this in terms of the fact that if I had been in that situation, it would have been a far more difficult call than it is for me sitting here as a dispassionate observer talking about this 2 years later or 10 years later or 25 years later.
It's very easy to judge the people. And their first reaction was, he needed killing. Our streets are safe now. They weren't safe before. Our daughters can walk, to school without fear. And this was their kind of uniform natural reaction when they were asked about, well, the rightness or wrongness of it. If you persisted with them, which I did over the years, and I don't mean persisted in cross-examining them about it, but if you persisted in talking to them and becoming friends and drinking coffee with them and going to the tractor pulls, like I did, you would start to see the moral conflict in them. And that pained me as much as anything. Particularly the women were more likely to admit that that they were bothered by it, that they are Christians and they know that there's a commandment against what had happened. And they were participating now in the silence. And you could see it in their face and they would admit it. At the end of the conversation, though, they would come back and say, we really had no choice.
Yes. And do you think in this particular circumstance, I know as I think this thing through and as I have read your book and as I've listened to you talk, it kind of reminds me, my dad is a product of that culture. He's a Christian. He has, in the best sense of the word, I think the kinds of small-town Middle Western values that people who would watch Andy Griffith's Mayberry RFD or Andy Griffith's Old Mayberry Show would identify with. And yet he was also involved in a lot of things as an Air Force colonel who had about a dozen years at Air Force Intelligence, things that he doesn't talk about to this day. And has not discussed with anyone on the outside, never would. He will take those things to his grave, I'm sure. And in that, it seems to me that we find ourselves, or at least I found myself identifying with the torturous burdens being carried by those who were in the middle of this conflict, had not sought it out, but were in the middle of it in that circumstances drove a group of people, at least three apparently in terms of actual shooters, into ending this man's life in a premeditated killing. Those who were not a direct party to the shooting or to any possible conspiracy that may have led to that shooting, nonetheless knew things and witnessed things that had those been shared with the grand jury and the FBI would have obviously begun to unravel the whole situation. It seems to me that what you're saying is that those folks really have, for the last 25 years, those who are still living, continue to have a tremendous amount of internal conflict over this and a tremendous sense of burden that they, in effect, are carrying something that they wish they weren't carrying, that they know things they wish they didn't know, and somehow they wish they could reverse to a period of time before July 10th, 1981, and could have lived a life in more maybe blissful ignorance of these types of things.
Oh, absolutely. And they wouldn't articulate it the way you just did and the way I would. If you probed and so forth, you wouldn't get that degree of ability to explain it. But it is there, and you can see them. You can feel it and see it in them. And they are starting. There was another horrible crime there, I think, that we talked about off air, this young woman, Bobby Jo Stinnett, about a year and a half ago, was killed by a woman from Kansas, and she was pregnant, and the baby was, she was cut open, and the baby was taken from her. And that gained a tremendous amount. By the way, the baby lived, and the woman is being prosecuted. But that gained a tremendous amount of publicity, and it brought the world down on this town again. All the news trucks, all the reporters from around the world, Japan, New York, L.A., Thailand. And once again, they were characterized as this kind of, it's a town with a curse on it. It's a bad town. And so there, when I was there, I started to feel that they are now having some doubts about their own goodness. And that just makes me feel even worse for them, because neither one of these two events were they the main force in bringing about. So their own self-esteem, if a town can have a self-esteem, is plummeting. And I feel very bad about it.
Well, it seems to me that in a very significant way, it's kind of like an existential crisis that involves several things. One, of course, is the McElroy case that we've been talking about. The second is the case you've just mentioned in more recent times, last year and a half. But then you look at the economies of these towns as well. I know that my parents recently returned from this small town in Iowa that they came from, and they went up there to see a relative get married. And my dad was talking about the fact that the town had clearly declined in population. The main street of the town had clearly declined as far as the shops that were there, the businesses that were there or no longer there, as the case may be, and that outside of the folks that were still plugging away very industriously in the farming community, those who were landowners, that for the rest of the folks who were a part of this town, that was a declining element, and there was a sense that many people who had lived there, who had grown up there, had moved on for purposes of economic survival and so forth. And my dad commented to me, not a great deal, but he mentioned something about the overarching sadness that he felt at seeing this town in 2006 and where it is today in relation to where it may have been as a community in the late 1930s. It seems to me that maybe Skidmore's going through that same type of sadness and crisis.
Oh, they absolutely are. I used to think that those small, in order for a small town to survive, it needed a bank, it needed a post office, and it needed a gas station. And when I was there, Skidmore had all three of those. It also had a coffee shop and a convenience store. In the last several years, the bank has closed, the convenience store is closed, and the school is closed. So it's on a probably irreversible slide. There's no opportunity there. You talk to the students, to the kids who live there, and there's no reason to stay. The other part of it, of course, is the old story about the big box stores. Maryville, the county seat, is 14 miles away, and it has the Walmart and the Home Depot and all those stores, which can drain off the purchasing power. So it's not being fixed up. As stores close, they're kind of just left there. It's really kind of sad. It's just kind of deteriorating overall. There's always a couple of people who hang on. I'm sure your dad would agree with this. There's always a couple of people committed to maintaining the town. You know, they run for city council and they try and do all these things, but it's kind of they're swimming upstream, to put it easily.
Yes, and you know, as I think about this, I was looking not too long ago at a something from World War II that was put out by the little newspaper in this town of Hamburg, Iowa. It was called the Hamburg Reporter, and they had an album that they put out either toward the end of World War II or right afterward, chronicling all the men and women in this little town who were in some branch of the armed forces of the United States. And in the very back of the thing, there was a sad compendium of people from this little town who had lost their lives in various famous excursions in World War II. And when we come back, I'm going to take up some of those themes with Harry McLean of In Broad Daylight. This is Mark Dankoff's America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. You can give us a call at 1-800-313-9443. Stay tuned.
Since 1988, Herbal Healer Academy has been the global supplier of the finest natural medicines. We specialize in keeping you alive and healthy. We provide outstanding products like ECX, colloidal silver, olive leaf extract, oregano oil, and hundreds of herbals, oils, books, and educational materials. We have homeopathic detox solutions for chemtrails, radiation, MSG, and aspartame poisoning. We also train naturopathic healers via correspondence education. Why wait any longer? Go ahead and do it today. Sign up on the web and receive our new 120-page catalog and a current Herbal Healer newsletter free. Simply log on to herbalhealer.com and check out the online member testimonials and our hundreds of exceptional products. That's herbalhealer.com, your website for safe, effective, natural alternatives and education. That's herbalhealer.com.
In the United States, it is now estimated that over 90% of family income is now being used to pay back consumer debt. Because of financial problems, mostly from credit card debt, approximately 1 in 4 families struggle to pay bills on even basic necessities such as mortgage, food, and utilities. And with millions of people desperately searching for a fresh start, North American Educational Services is here to help you regain your financial independence. We are very proud that the Debt Relief Educational Services Program has helped over 8,100 families nationwide since 1998, eliminating over $215 million of credit card debt, and still counting, and enabled clients to stop monthly payments immediately. The NAES program is unique, designed to help you, the consumer, not your creditors. To take back your financial freedom, call 1-888-245-7097. That's 1-888-245-7097. Or visit www.integritydebtoptions.com.
Your life demands long-lasting power for everything. If you want to find the best battery selection at the best prices, then BatteryStation.com is the place for you. Find common or hard-to-find batteries for practically everything, from computer backup units and camcorders to cell phones and wheelchairs. Go to BatteryStation.com for all your battery supply needs. At BatteryStation.com, you'll also discover high-tech LED tactical flashlights for every task, from trusted names like Surefire, Tektite, Gerber, Pelican, and more. BatteryStation.com offers lights featuring super bright, super tough, long life LED technology. At BatteryStation.com, you'll find tough, crush proof, waterproof, airtight, hard cases of all sizes from Pelican, Otter, and S3 Extreme. Visit them today, BatteryStation.com. It's all one word, BatteryStation.com. Or call 417-257-7799. That's 417-257-7799. Your source for batteries and accessories at very low prices. BatteryStation.com.
We're back. This is Mark Dankos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Harry McLean, the author of In Broad Daylight, originally issued as a publication of the New York Times. And secondly, it is now coming out under the auspices of St. Martin Press. And as you look at this book, I guarantee you, you won't be disappointed reading 406 pages in relation to what happened in Skidmore, Missouri on July 10th, 1981, and in regard to all the things that have transpired in the lives of the people of this town in the quarter of a century since the original event. I wanted to warn Harry that we are going to have a series of breaks here in the next 5 to 7 or 8 minutes, and then we'll have a longer period of time for uninterrupted conversation. I wanted to take this opportunity to mention to our listeners that you can support Republic Broadcasting Network by contacting us with your gifts online at rbnlive.com or calling us at the office at 1-800-724-2719. That's rbnlive.com on the web or at 1-800-724-2719. You can also obtain several things from Republic Broadcasting Network that might be of interest to you in this Christmas season. You can have new Republic Broadcasting Network T-shirts. Those are also available at rbnlive.com, as well as notyranny.com, or you can call the office at 1-800-724-2719. The due date for those for Christmas is December 20th. Also in regard to RBN, you can have Aaron Russo's new DVD, America, Freedom to Fascism. That's available for $19.95 plus $4.95 shipping and handling, directly from the Republic Broadcasting Network, which, again, you can contact at rbnlive.com on the World Wide Web or give us a call at 1-800-724-2719. Harry, getting back to where we were before the break, and I'll warn you, in these next few minutes, we're going to be interrupted a couple times before there's a longer period for conversation. To me, as I look at this whole thing with Skidmore, and you mentioned Marysville, the county seat there in the county.
Right.
You know, thinking about, of course, the Walmarts and the Home Depots and the way in which those types of operations, I think, have certainly altered the economic and cultural character of small-town America. I've seen that in the Texas Hill Country here outside of San Antonio in the last 10 years or so. I'm also reminded of, you know, this whole move, unquestioned move toward a global economy. You know, you talk about NAFTA and GATT and the World Trade Organization. We're now talking about the Security and Prosperity Partnership Arrangement for North America, this talk of a North American Union that Robert Pastor of American University was discussing a little bit today at WorldNet Daily. And quite clearly, there is a move toward a globalization of the economy. Looking at this North American Union that's being proposed, there's a highway that they're talking about that would begin at Lorenzo Cardenas in Mexico, a port town. It would come up all the way through Mexico, run right through the I-35 corridor of Texas, going through San Antonio and Dallas. It'll eventually make its way to Kansas City, where all kinds of foreign products will be distributed through the use of that highway. When we get back, we'll discuss that a little bit and what the ramifications of that type of thing are for the culture of places like Skidmore, Missouri, what it means for the future of the American small town. This is Mark Dankos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Back with Harry McLean of In Broad Daylight when we return.
Everyone agrees our children are the future leaders of this great nation. How can we expect the founding values of our great republic to continue with future generations when these same values are being phased out of the government-run school system? There is a solution. The Little Red Schoolhouse Project, a community-based school system founded by Dr. Jake Wade to provide a biblical and constitutionally based education for our children. Help us prepare the next generation in our fight for freedom. Ask us how you can help by writing to Providence Christian Academy, 280 Tenny Creek Road, Dale, Texas, 78616, or by calling 512-398-4833. Once again, that is Providence Christian Academy, 280 Tenny Creek Road, Dale, Texas, 78616. Support your local Little Red Schoolhouse. Call 512-398-4833 and ask how you can help ensure no student is turned away.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.